This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, this is Lori Richards.
And Irene Friedman.
And we will be bringing you world and national news from USA Today, and Irene will start us off.
Okay, on the front page, details in North Carolina standoff emerge, four officers dead. Authorities describe shooting that left four additional officers injured in Charlotte. The story is by Christopher Kahn and Trevor Hughes of USA Today. Four law enforcement officers were killed and four were injured when gunfire erupted at a house in Charlotte, North Carolina, where authorities first arrived to serve a warrant. The suspect who fired at officers in the confrontation late Monday was shot to death on the lawn of the house, and two other people inside the home were taken in for questioning. At least one of them is believed to have shot at law enforcement. In the hours since, condolences for the officers involved in one of the deadliest recent attacks on law enforcement stretch from the local community to the White House. They are heroes who made the ultimate sacrifice, rushing into harm's way to protect us, President Joe Biden said in a statement Tuesday. We mourn for them and their loved ones, and we pray for the recoveries of the courageous officers who were wounded. Biden also spoke with Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles to express his condolences and support for the community. Biden added more needs to be done to protect law enforcement. That means funding them so they have the resources they need to do their jobs and keep us safe. And it means taking additional action to combat the scourge of gun violence. Around 1:30 p.m. Monday, officers with the U.S. Marshals Task Force arrived at a home in a suburb of Charlotte to serve several active warrants against 39-year-old Terry Clark Hughes, Jr., who was wanted for possession of a firearm by a convicted felon and two counts of fleeing to elude, according to the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. Armed with a high-powered rifle, Hughes fired upon the approaching task force officers, striking several of them, police said. Officers returned fire and shot the man, who was pronounced dead on the front lawn. From inside the house, another shooter began firing. After an hours-long standoff, authorities besieged the home with armored vehicles and located at least one assault rifle. Two women were brought in for questioning after they left the house, police said in a statement. Johnny Jennings, chief of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, had said earlier that a 17-year-old male and a woman were being questioned. They love their work. Eight officers, four from the United States Marshals Fugitive Task Force and four from the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, were shot in the confrontation. Of the officers who were killed, three were from the task force, and the other was from the police department. Two of the slain task force members, Sam Peloche and William Alden Elliott, worked for the state's Department of Adult Correction for 14 years, a statement from the department said. Peloche is survived by his wife and two children, according to the state's correction department. Elliot was married and had one child. Both officers were pronounced dead at a hospital. They loved their work and were passionate about their roles in protecting our communities, the statement said. The officers died as heroes and made the ultimate sacrifice in their service to our state. Families, police in mourning. U.S. Marshals Deputy Thomas M. Weeks, Jr., 48, of Mooresville, North Carolina, was killed in the shooting, the agency said in a statement. Weeks, a husband and the father of four children, was a 13-year veteran of the Marshals Service. After hours in the hospital, Joshua Iyer, a 6-year veteran of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, died from his injuries. Iyer was married and has a 3-year-old son. He fought for several hours and passed away from his injuries with his wife and family by his side tonight, Jennings, chief of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, wrote on X. I am truly grateful for his bravery, service, and ultimate sacrifice. He will never be forgotten, and we are forever indebted. Neighbor recalls shootout. Sang Chuen, 54 was just leaving his house shortly after 1 p.m. when members of the marshal's task force raced into his yard, taking cover behind a powder blue Honda sedan. As gunfire began blasting through the yard of the two-story home next door, Chewin began live streaming to Facebook from his iPhone. Chewin said he watched as one and then another officer were hit by gunfire from the rear of the brick home, and he heard the frantic calls for assistance. Chewin said two women ran outside the house, as did another man, and authorities crashed an armored vehicle through his backyard to reach the two downed officers. They do what they gotta do to get the officer who was shot, he said, looking at the twisted fencing and deep ruts left by the vehicle, which officers later used to rip the front of the house open so they could send a drone in. I've seen a lot of movies and knew what was coming. A long criminal history. Hughes had served time in prison after multiple felony convictions, including for breaking and entering, fleeing police in a high-speed chase, and possession of a firearm, state records show. In 2010, he served 6 months in prison for a felony breaking and entering charge related to an incident the year before, according to the North Carolina Department of Adult Correction. In June 2012, he was arrested on charges of speeding to elude arrest. At the time, he was the subject of several active warrants to avoid capture. He turned around near a checkpoint and sped away, beginning a chase that reached speeds of over 100 miles per hour, reported Charlotte news station WCNC. Hughes was convicted of fleeing and possession of a firearm by a felon in October 2012. In September 2013, he was released from prison, authorities said. In May 2021, Hughes was arrested on several charges, including possession of marijuana, paraphernalia, and eluding arrest in a motor vehicle, according to the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office. He was released the same day, records show. Contributing to the article, Jonathan Limehouse, Tao Nguyen, and Michael Loria, and we have a couple pictures here, Sang Chowen, 54, who was just leaving his house early Monday afternoon when the gunfire began, shows how officers raced into his yard and took cover behind a Honda sedan. I've seen a lot of movies and knew what was coming, and he's demonstrating how he's kind of squatting behind the car. And then authorities used an armored vehicle to tear off the front of a home and send in a drone after gunfire killed four law enforcement officers on Monday, including three on the U.S. Marshals Task Force. And in the photo, the two-story home, the entire front has been pretty much demolished. You can see well into the home from the damage done by the armored vehicle. Lori?
Anti-war protests intensify across U.S. Colombia suspends a lead negotiator. Demonstrators seize academic building. By Eduardo Cuevas and John Bacon of USA Today. New York. Columbia University severely restricted access to campus Tuesday and began suspending students involved in the Gaza war protests, while demonstrators seized an academic building and blocked the entrance with a human chain. Mahmoud Khalil, a graduate student and lead negotiator for Columbia University Apartheid Divest in almost 2 weeks of talks with the administration, returned to campus Tuesday morning to find he was suspended and his ID card blocked. Negotiations ended without an agreement Monday. This goes against the norms. I was not a part of this encampment, Khalil told USA Today, standing outside campus gates. Yet again, this shows the randomness and the arbitrary measures the university is taking against students. The academic building, Hamilton Hall, is a short walk from where the demonstrators protesting Israel's war in Gaza have occupied an encampment that for 2 weeks has been the epicenter for campus protests nationwide. Shortly after 12:30 a.m., students broke into the building and barricaded themselves with wooden chairs, metal tables, and trash cans. An autonomous group of students reclaimed the building as Hind Hall, in honor of Hind Rajab, a six-year-old girl from Gaza, Columbia Students for Justice in Palestine said in a social media post. We continue to stand in solidarity with Palestinian liberation. A Heinz Hall banner flew from a window in the building as supporters linked arms to form a line, protecting the entrance while others demonstrated leading chants in support of Gaza. Effective immediately, access to the main campus has been limited to students residing in residential buildings on campus and employees who provide essential services to campus buildings, labs, and residential student life, the school said in a statement. The safety of every single member of this community is paramount. Columbia protesters demand the school halt investments with companies profiting from Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza, and they want amnesty for students and faculty involved in the protest. In other developments, 79 people were arrested in connection with a protest at the University of Texas, the Travis County Sheriff's Office said Tuesday. 78 of those arrested were charged with criminal trespass, and one person received an additional charge of obstructing a highway or passageway. Dozens of protesters at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill were detained Tuesday as police began breaking down the Triangle Gaza Solidarity encampment after school officials demanded protesters remove the tents and leave the area. Officials at Portland State University in Oregon closed the campus Tuesday, citing an ongoing library incident. The school asked the police to help remove dozens of protesters occupying the building. Last week, the university paused gifts or grants from Boeing pending review of weapons sales to Israel. California State Polytechnic University, Humboldt, said in a Tuesday, its campus will be closed until May 10th as law enforcement begin a series of actions to restore order. Two buildings were cleared and secured, and 35 people were arrested, the school said in a statement. White House denounces protest occupations. The White House on Tuesday condemned the surge in protests that seize and occupy university buildings. White House spokesman John Kirby said the Biden administration was monitoring the escalating protests on U.S. campuses. The president believes that forcibly taking over a building on campus is absolutely the wrong approach. That is not an example of peaceful protests, Kirby said at a briefing. White House Deputy Press Secretary Andrew Bates said in a statement that Biden respects freedom of expression but believes protests must be lawful. Forcibly taking over buildings is not peaceful. It is wrong. And hate speech and hate symbols have no place in America, Bates said. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona, speaking at a Senate budget hearing Tuesday morning, said, "What is happening on our campuses is abhorrent." Cardona said his agency has more than 100 pending civil rights investigations concerning allegations of discrimination, including anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim harassment at Columbia. Hate has no place on our campuses, and I'm very concerned with the reports of anti-Semitism, he said. Contributing to this article are Zachary Schmelly, USA Today, Sky Sipe, Austin American Statesman, and Reuters. And we have a couple of pictures. The first one is Columbia students wait in line, hoping to enter campus Tuesday. Access was restricted to students who live on campus and other essential personnel after protesters seized a building Tuesday morning. And they are lined up against, it looks like, the main gate to the campus. And then in front of one of their academic buildings, amid ongoing protests Tuesday, people stand near a campus entrance by Columbia University's Hamilton Hall, which was taken over and barricaded by protesters early Tuesday morning. Irene?
Okay, finishing up the front page. Feds plan to change stance on cannabis. Proposal reclassifies it as a less dangerous drug. By Janine Santucci, Eduardo Cuevas, and Michael Collins of USA Today. The Biden administration is poised to make a landmark change to the federal government's position on marijuana with a proposed plan that would no longer consider marijuana among the most dangerous and addictive substances. in what would be the biggest change in marijuana policy the federal government has taken since pot was first outlawed. The Drug Enforcement Administration will take public comments on a plan to recategorize marijuana under the Controlled Substances Act, according to a source familiar with the process. The news was first reported by the Associated Press. The Department of Justice will send its recommendation to reclassify marijuana from a Schedule I drug to a Schedule III drug to the White House Office of Management and Budget, according to the source, who was not authorized to speak publicly. The Justice Department was expected to have transmitted the recommendation Tuesday, the source said. The plan wouldn't legalize marijuana at the federal level outright, but it would reclassify it from a Schedule I drug, believed highly dangerous, addictive, and without medical use, to a Schedule III drug that can be lawfully prescribed as medication. Marijuana has been a Schedule I drug since the Controlled Substances Act was signed in 1970. It is significant for these federal agencies, and the DEA and FDA in particular, to acknowledge publicly for the first time what many patients and advocates have known for decades, that cannabis is a safe and effective therapeutic agent for tens of millions of Americans, said Paul Armentano, deputy director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, or NORML, N-O-R-M-L, which advocates for cannabis to be removed altogether from the list of controlled substances. The bureaucratic move is only a small step toward what advocates hope will be full legalization of the drug. However, the new proposed classification does not fully address the inconsistencies between federal restrictions and the laws in a growing number of states that have authorized medical and recreational use of pot. 24 states and Washington, D.C. have legalized the recreational use of marijuana, and 14 other states authorize it for medical use, according to the Pew Research Center. Rescheduling the cannabis plant to Schedule III fails to adequately address this conflict, as existing state legislation laws, both adult use and medical, will continue to be in conflict with federal regulations, thereby perpetuating the existing divide between state and federal marijuana policies, Armentano said in a statement. The federal proposal to reschedule marijuana would have broad support among voters. A nationwide survey last fall commissioned by the Coalition for Cannabis Rescheduling Reform found nearly 60% of likely voters supported rescheduling, with 65% of younger voters 18 to 25 favoring it, the highest of any demographic group polled. Overall, the number of Americans who think marijuana should be legal reached a record high at 70%, according to a Gallup poll in the fall. For decades, marijuana has been listed under the Controlled Substances Act as a Schedule I drug alongside heroin, LSD, and ecstasy. The Act categorizes drugs based on their potential for abuse, addiction, and medical use. Schedule I drugs are outlawed under federal law level and deemed to be without accepted medical use. In 2022, President Joe Biden directed the Department of Health and Human Services to conduct a review of how marijuana is classified. And last year, HHS recommended it be rescheduled to Schedule III alongside drugs like Tylenol with codeine and anabolic steroids. The Justice Department did its own analysis and reached the same conclusion, the source said. The proposal will undergo a public review period. The source did not say when the proposed rule would be open to public comment. Representative Andy Harris, Republican from Maryland, has previously criticized federal efforts to change marijuana's classification. Harris was a physician at the Johns Hopkins Hospital, according to his online biography. Removing restrictions on an addictive gateway drug like marijuana is a dangerous mistake. Numerous studies, including a recent and reputable study published by JAMA, points to the negative impact recreational marijuana has on the body and brain, Harris said in a Tuesday social media post on X, formerly known as Twitter. Experts previously told USA Today that marijuana's placement on Schedule I was not based on credible scientific evidence of its perils, but once it was listed, researchers and advocates faced a heavy burden trying to prove it shouldn't face such stiff restrictions. What exactly does rescheduling cannabis mean? Placing marijuana in Schedule III puts it on par with drugs such as ketamine, Testosterone, anabolic steroids, or Tylenol with codeine that have moderate to low potential for physical and psychological dependence, according to the DEA. Schedule III drugs can be legally prescribed by licensed healthcare providers and dispensed by licensed pharmacies. Rescheduling could also help resolve a massive federal tax burden that has been placed on cannabis companies, which were effectively seen as drug traffickers for tax purposes. But rescheduling marijuana does make it legal to use recreationally and doesn't change much about current state cannabis programs, said Jay Wexler, who teaches a seminar about marijuana laws at Boston University. It would still be a controlled substance even with the new announcement. Wexler and other policy experts and advocates say rescheduling is not a solution, but it could be a sign. The federal government is catching up with public opinion and consensus in the medical field that there are therapeutic benefits to marijuana, along with some risk. Rescheduling is a step forward, but it is not nearly enough. And there's no reason to keep cannabis in the Controlled Substances Act, Wexler previously told USA Today. What are possible risks of marijuana? Because of its classification, marijuana has been hard to study. But the move to reschedule marijuana is due in large part to its lower public health risks, federal scientists have said. In a leaked HHS documents, officials wrote to the DEA to support lowering its classification to Schedule III. Its risk for addiction was lower than other drugs and it had medical benefits. Unlike Schedule I and II drugs, HHS researchers said. Still, scientists said users develop moderate to low physical dependence on it, and there is some risk of psychological dependence. However, they noted the withdrawal symptoms are relatively mild compared with alcohol. Marijuana is more comparable to tobacco, they said. There are no known deaths from a marijuana overdose, according to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, or NIDA, N-I-D-A, but it does affect physical and mental health. Marijuana can cause permanent IQ loss for people who begin using it at a young age, the Institute said. Additionally, long-term use has been associated with temporary paranoia and hallucinations, and it can exacerbate symptoms with disorders such as schizophrenia, NIDA said. Marijuana smoke has a similar health impact to tobacco smoke. NIDA found people who smoke marijuana frequently develop issues with breathing, akin to tobacco smokers. Smoking cannabis, the most common way to consume the drug, may have additional risk because of particular matter a person inhales, according to a recent study in the Journal of the American Heart Association. Researchers noted cannabis smoke isn't all that different from tobacco smoke, the only difference being the added effect of the psychoactive drug THC in marijuana, rather than nicotine in tobacco. Respiratory issues include daily cough, phlegm, and a higher risk of lung infections. However, the Institute said it's unclear if marijuana causes a greater risk of lung cancer. Smoking marijuana also increases heart rate, which can increase the chance of heart attack, especially among older people and people with heart conditions. The Heart Association Journal study linked increased cannabis use with an increased risk of heart attack and stroke. Despite common use, little is known about the risk of cannabis use, and in particular, the cardiovascular disease risk. The study's lead author, Abra Jeffers, a data analyst at Boston's Massachusetts General Hospital, said in a statement, "The perceptions of the harmfulness of smoking cannabis are decreasing, and people have not considered cannabis use dangerous to their health. However, previous research suggested that cannabis could be associated with cardiovascular disease." Jeffers noted that smoking cannabis, which is the predominant way it is used, could pose other risks because it involves inhaling particulate matter. In the study published in late February, researchers examined Centers for Disease Control and Prevention survey data of over 400,000 adults from 2016 to 2020, looking at self-reported cannabis use with cardiovascular outcomes such as heart disease, heart attacks, and strokes. People who use marijuana daily had a 25% higher chance of having a heart attack and a 42% higher chance of stroke than those who didn't use it at all. Proposal reflects potential for health benefits. The cannabis plant has been used for medicinal purposes for centuries, if not millennia. It appears to help with treating pain, insomnia, anxiety, and glaucoma, among other health conditions. Still, evidence is mixed, and more research into its health benefits is needed. Researchers at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health said in August, while the FDA hasn't approved the cannabis plant for any medical use, federal regulators have approved several drugs containing cannabinoids or substances such as THC or CBD found in the cannabis plant, according to the National Institute of Health. These include Epidiolex, a purified form of CBD ingested orally that is FDA approved to treat seizures associated with two forms of epilepsy. Marinol and Syndros both contain synthetic THC and are used to treat nausea and vomiting caused by chemotherapy. Nabilone, another synthetic similar to THC, is approved as the brand name drug Sasamet for people with HIV/AIDS who experience weight loss and appetite loss. A 2017 federal report found cannabis or cannabinoids are more likely to reduce pain symptoms for patients with chronic pain. Additionally, there is some evidence that cannabis is effective in treating symptoms of multiple sclerosis, particularly addressing the stiff or rigid muscles caused by the disease. One cannabinoid drug, nabiximol, a mouth spray that has both THC and CBD, has been approved in several countries, but not in the United States. Under the brand name Sativex, it has shown pain relief for people with cancer or multiple sclerosis. Other research has examined cannabis's use to treat post-traumatic stress disorder, but the NIH said the evidence is mixed. Lori?
Okay, moving on to page 2. NASA is giving the moon its own time zone, by George Petras and Janet Lorkey of USA Today. It's going to start getting crowded on the moon, and we'll need a precise lunar timekeeping system, a shared clock, to coordinate missions and prevent disasters. Time moves a bit faster on the moon than on Earth because the moon's mass is smaller than that of Earth and its gravity is weaker. That means the moon is going to get its own time zone. NASA has been asked to establish a unified standard time for the moon and other celestial bodies by the end of 2026. That request came from the White House, specifically the Office of Science and Technology Policy, on April 2nd. The same clock that we have on Earth would move at a different rate on the moon, said Kevin Coggins, NASA's Space Communications and Navigation Chief, in an interview with Reuters. The difference is slight. The Earth-Moon time difference is 58.7 microseconds per Earth day. A microsecond is 1/1000th of a second. Microseconds are often used as measurements in electronics, computing, and telecommunication applications. On Earth, Coordinated Universal Time, or UTC, is the standard used to set all time zones around the world. Eastern Time is 4 hours behind UTC. The new lunar time zone will be known as Coordinated Lunar Time, or LTC. It's not yet determined whether the moon will have one or multiple time zones. And in a graph, we have for Earth, one day is equal to 24 hours, one full rotation of axis. One lunar day is equal to 29.5306 hours. Where will coordinated lunar time be used? LTC will be used in operations in cislunar space, the region around the Earth that extends to the moon and past its orbit. It includes the lunar surface, lunar orbits, and Earth-Moon Lagrange points. Lagrange points are gravity-balanced positions in space between two bodies, the Earth and Moon in this example, in which objects are such as spacecraft can stay in position. Lagrange points are easy to reach, and many spacecraft use them to perform observations, space.com says. sun's Lagrange points. Spacecraft are able to orbit the sun in a stable orbit like Earth's at five different Lagrange points, L1 through L5. Earth's Lagrange points. The Earth has similar Lagrange points like the Sun. This is where spacecraft or satellites can be placed in stable orbits around Earth. Why is precise time needed? That 58.7 microseconds may not sound like much to worry about. An eye blink, for example, takes 0.1 to 0.4 seconds, or 100,000 to 400,000 microseconds. But the time discrepancy becomes crucial in space missions, which require extreme precision for communication, tracking, and navigation. LTC is also needed for secure data transfers between spacecraft and for matched communication among Earth, lunar satellites, bases, and astronauts, Reuters reported. And because future missions will be multinational, all participants will need to be synchronized. Will the Moon's time system be similar to that of Earth? It could be. Earth's UTC uses a group of 450 highly precise atomic clocks in 85 time laboratories around the world. The Office of Science and Technology Policy Directive suggests an ensemble of clocks on the Moon could be used to set up the Moon's LTC. The White House directive also says LTC must have traceability or a calculated connection to Earth's coordinated universal time, specificity and accuracy to measure very short spans of time necessary for precise scientific study and spacecraft landings, self-sufficiency in case connection with Earth is lost, scalability so other celestial objects or space environments can use it. NASA will work with the Departments of Commerce, Defense, State, and Transportation to create and implement the lunar time zone. Irene?
Okay, next article. Wife says former MSU coach pulled money. Alleges he used $1.5 million to pay his legal expenses. By Kenny Jacoby of USA Today. The wife of former Michigan State University head football coach Mel Tucker has filed for divorce and accuses him in a request for a restraining order of pulling money without notice from their joint funds, including $1.5 million to pay his legal expenses. Joe Allen and Mel Tucker were granted a mutual restraining order preventing the dissipation of marital assets on Thursday by a judge in Ingham County, Michigan, court records show. Her divorce complaint was filed with the court 3 weeks earlier on April 5th. In her petition for the restraining order, Joellen Tucker indicated she sought the order because just before she initiated the divorce action, Mel Tucker withdrew all the money from his two retirement accounts, including his Michigan State account. She said he transferred them to an individual account to which she did not have access. She also accused Tucker of spending more than $1.5 million from their joint line of credit to defend himself in a third-party litigation, which he described as not a marital expense, plus another $100,000 since the divorce filing. As recently as April 23rd, the amount he has spent on litigation, her petition said, is excessive compared to the balance of the party's marital estate. Mel Tucker and his attorney did not immediately return messages seeking comment. Mel Tucker was sued in Ingham County Court in October by Brenda Tracy, a prominent rape survivor and activist, who accused him of sexually harassing and exploiting her, allegations substantiated by an MSU investigation. She was granted a restraining order to stop him from releasing private text messages he had obtained from the cell phone of her deceased best friend and business assistant, which she said contained personal and business information. That litigation is ongoing. Last month, Tracy also filed an intent to sue Tucker and the university, a mandatory precursor to filing a lawsuit against a government agency, accusing him of damaging her reputation and future earnings, hamstringing her charitable work, and causing severe psychological and emotional harm. Tracy and her nonprofit Set the Expectation, which aims to reduce sexual violence by engaging men, are seeking damages of more than $75 million. Mel Tucker had hired Tracy in August 2021 to speak to his team about sexual violence prevention. After their initial meeting, he expressed interest in Tracy's cause of engaging men as the solution to gender-based violence, and they struck up a professional relationship and friendship. Over the next year, Tucker twice invited Tracy back to East Lansing, first to be the honorary captain at a Spartans football game, and again for a future training with coaches and players. During that time, Tucker made a series of romantic overtures toward Tracy, who would later tell campus investigators that she walked a tightrope, trying to set boundaries with Tucker while maintaining their business partnership. Each time, she said, he initially pulled back, then resumed advances that increased in severity. The pattern culminated in a phone call in April 2022, which Tracy said Tucker masturbated and made sexual comments without her consent. Tracy said the next and last time they spoke in August 2022, Tucker threatened to ruin her career if she spoke about his conduct. She filed a complaint with the university's Title IX office that December. A USA Today investigation in September revealed the allegations for the first time publicly. MSU fired Tucker for cause 2 weeks later, canceling the roughly $75 million remaining on his record 10-year $95 million contract. Even Tucker's version of events, that he and Tracy had been in a romantic relationship and had consensual phone sex, constituted a fireable offense, athletic director Alan Haller wrote in his termination letter. After a 7-month inquiry by an outside investigator hired by MSU, a different outside hearing officer concluded in October that Tucker sexually harassed and exploited Tracy in the April 2022 phone call, made unwanted sexual advances toward her in the 8 months before the call, and engaged in quid pro quo sexual harassment afterward when he ended their business relationship. Another outside attorney hired by MSU denied Tucker's appeal in January, affirming the hearing officer's decision that Tracy's version of events was more plausible, consistent, and supported by the evidence. Tucker and his attorneys indicated he would sue MSU for wrongful termination. To date, they have not done so. Lori?
Okay, moving on to page 3. Judge fines Trump for 9 violations of gag order. By Aisha Bagchi and Kinsey Crowley of USA Today. New York. The 9th day of Donald Trump's New York hush money trial started with a slap on the wrist from Judge Juan Merchan. Merchan said Trump violated a gag order 9 times and would be fined $1,000 per violation. As directed, Trump's Truth Social account removed posts that Merchan ruled in violation, including attacks on former Trump attorney Michael Cohen, potential jurors, other witnesses, and prosecutors. There will be a hearing later this week to address 4 new alleged violations. In good news for the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, Merchan said Trump may attend his youngest child, Barron Trump's, high school graduation on May 17th. Prosecutors say Trump falsified business records to hide a conspiracy to unlawfully interfere with the 2016 election by authorizing a $130,000 hush money payment from Cohen to porn star Stormy Daniels. Daniels claims she and Trump had sex. Trump denies her claim and has pleaded not guilty. Before entering the courthouse, Trump criticized campus Israel-Hamas protests, saying he'd much rather be in Georgia, and urged reporters to read his Time interview, in which he outlined plans for a second term. Also, as usual, he complained about the judge, the trial, and the chilly courtroom, where he was accompanied for the first time by a family member, his son, Eric Trump. Bankers and lawyers. The 2 core witnesses of the day were members of classically New York professions, finance and law. Gary Farrow described arrangements that Cohen, then his client at First Republic Bank, made for the hush money payments to Daniels. In October 2016, Cohen asked Farrow to immediately open an account for a new limited liability company for his real estate investment consulting. It did not raise alarms for Farrow, he said. But prosecutors say it was a shell company to pay Daniels the $130,000. If Farrow had known the truth, the transfer would have proceeded much more slowly, if at all, he testified. Transferring money on behalf of a political candidate would have triggered additional due diligence, Farrow said. Paying an adult film star would certainly have delayed the transaction, and it's possible the bank wouldn't have approved the wire transfer at all out of reputation concerns, Farrow said. And he generally didn't assist clients with shell companies except to maintain anonymity for owning a home, boat, or plane. Then lawyer Keith Davidson, who represented Daniels and former Playboy model Karen McDougal in their hush money negotiations, took the stand. McDougal also alleges she had an affair with Trump, which he denies. The messy highlight was a series of texts between Davidson and Dylan Howard, the editor-in-chief of the National Enquirer. "I have a blockbuster Trump story," Davidson texted about McDougal's account. Howard responded, "Talk first thing. I will get you more than anyone for it. You know why." Davidson pressed him, "Don't forget about Cohen. Time is of the essence. The girl is being cornered by the estrogen mafia." Forced to explain that comment, Davidson said it was very unfortunate and regrettable and said it referred to women leaning on McDougal to sign a deal with ABC News. As the two men were negotiating, Howard texted Davidson, "We are going to lay it on thick for her. Throw in an ambassadorship for me. I'm thinking Isle of Man," Davidson joked. He confirmed to prosecutor Joshua Steinglass that he understood the hush money deal would benefit Trump's campaign. The payment to Daniels was late, and Davidson believed she would go public. He communicated to Cohen that the level of dissatisfaction was quite high. And contributing to this article, David Jackson. Irene?
Moving on to page 4. Man who can't breathe, and can't breathe is in quotation marks, during arrest dies. Footage shows Ohioan face down, handcuffed. The article is by Nancy Molnar of USA Today. Canton, Ohio. Newly released body camera footage shows the arrest of an Ohio man who died during a confrontation with police, which an attorney representing its family said resembled the 2020 murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Frank Tyson, 53, died April 18th during an encounter with police after he crashed his car and entered a nearby private club. Both Tyson and Floyd said, "I can't breathe," before their deaths. The death of George Floyd traumatized and galvanized the American people. It led to a decisive call for change and an end to systemic police violence against black men, Bobby DiCello, an attorney for the Tyson family, said in a statement released Friday. "It's an unimaginable tragedy that only 4 years later history repeats itself. Why tackle him? Why kneel on him? How could you know he lost consciousness and then do nothing? These questions demand answers, and so we will get those answers for Frank and the whole Tyson family in this time of pain, grief, and disbelief," DiCello said. What happened to Frank Tyson? Authorities said Tyson crashed his car, then entered a private club and was acting erratically. Two police officers tried to remove Tyson from the club and took him to the floor during an ensuing scuffle. Tyson, who told people at the club that someone was trying to kill him before officers arrived, yelled, "They're trying to kill me," as officers fought with him. Police body camera footage released Wednesday by the city shows Tyson face down on the floor with his arms handcuffed behind his back for nearly 8 minutes before an officer realized he couldn't feel a pulse. Officers took the handcuffs off and applied chest compressions for several minutes. Tyson subsequently was treated by Canton Fire Department paramedics, took him to a local hospital where he was pronounced dead. Canton police have turned the investigation over to the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation. Officers Bo Shane Nagy and Camden Birch have been placed on administration leave. the Stark County Coroner's Office sent Tyson's body to the Cuyahoga County Medical Examiner's Office for an autopsy. The cause of death has not been released. The Stark County chapter of the NAACP on Friday posted a message on Facebook saying the civil rights group is monitoring the situation. Our thoughts and prayers are with the family, the group said. Expert questions Canton police response used on Frank Tyson. Kafani N. Turi, assistant professor of criminal justice and African American studies at Widener University in Chester, Pennsylvania, said officers should not have left Tyson face down on the floor for so long after they handcuffed his arms behind his back. Turi said that creates the potential for Tyson to suffocate due to the position of his body called positional asphyxiation. It takes less than 6 minutes for a life to expire in the context of a positional asphyxiation situation, Turi said. Turi said the responding officers also were indifferent to Tyson's condition, with one telling him to calm down. He said the gurgling noises Tyson made while lying on his stomach sounded similar to those made by Floyd. What is positional asphyxiation? The Department of Justice advised law enforcement about positional asphyxia in a June 1995 fact sheet. The federal agency advised officers to remove the subject from their stomach as soon as they are handcuffed and monitor them carefully, according to the National Institute of Justice, the Research Development and Evaluation Agency of the Justice Department. Turi said police also are trained to prevent positional asphyxiation. We learned in the police academy, and this is universal, he said. We all learned about positional asphyxiation. The chest cannot expand against a hard, flat structure. Our stomach and our thoracic cavity expands forward. And if you're in a prone position against a hard structure, you're going to suffocate. You're going to asphyxiate. We are trained that once you secure the person in handcuffs, you immediately sit them up in a resting position. Since 2000, more than 340 people have died in police custody due to asphyxia slash restraint, according to the Fatal Encounters database. A USA Today investigation found dozens said, "I can't breathe during the fatal restraints." Contributing to this, Nadia Yancey Bragg of USA Today. Lori?
Israel concerned ICC will issue warrants for Netanyahu and others. By Joey Garrison and Michael Collins, USA Today. Washington. Israeli officials are growing concerned the International Criminal Court could issue criminal warrants against their top officials, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, opening up the possibility they could be arrested if they travel abroad. Foreign Minister Israel Katz singled out rumors that the ICC will issue arrest warrants against high-ranking government and Israel Defense Forces officials in a statement. Katz said he instructed all Israel embassies across the world to immediately prepare for the outbreak of severe anti-Jewish and anti-Israeli anti-Semitic wave in the world. The ICC is investigating Hamas' October 7th attack, as well as Israel's brutal seven-month war in Gaza, aimed at defeating Hamas. The ICC, based in The Hague, can prosecute people for genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and aggression. Warrants for Netanyahu or other Israeli officials would not result in their immediate arrests. Neither the U.S. nor Israel are members of the court and do not recognize its jurisdiction. But warrants could prevent Israeli officials from traveling to the 124 countries that are ICC members where they would be subject to arrest. We've really been clear about the ICC investigation. We do not support it. We don't believe that they have the jurisdiction, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said. Which Israeli officials could the ICC charge? Although it's not clear what charges the ICC might bring, targets of criminal warrants could also include Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. There is nothing more twisted than trying to prevent Israel from defending itself against a murderous enemy that openly calls for the destruction of the state of Israel, Katz said. If orders are issued, they will harm the commanders and soldiers of the IDF and give a boost to the terrorist organization Hamas and the radical Islamic axis led by Iran, against which we are fighting. We will not bow our heads and we will not be deterred, he said. President Joe Biden and Netanyahu spoke by phone Sunday. The two leaders discussed efforts to deliver humanitarian aid into Gaza, according to the White House, and Biden stressed the need for this progress to be sustained and enhanced. Netanyahu, in a statement Friday on X, formerly Twitter, said Israel will never accept any attempt by the Hague Criminal Court to undermine its fundamental right to defend itself. He called the threat against IDF soldiers and Israeli public officials scandalous. Israel will continue until victory in our just war against the abominable terrorists who seek to destroy us. We will never stop defending ourselves, Netanyahu said. While the Hague Tribunal's decisions will not affect Israel's actions, they will set a dangerous precedent that threatens the soldiers and public figures of any democracy fighting criminal terrorism and dangerous aggression. Separately, the ICC is investigating actions by Israeli and Palestinian militants in Palestinian territories that date to the 2014 Israel-Hamas war. The Palestinian territories were admitted to the court with the status of a member state in 2015. Would ICC warrants affect a ceasefire deal? Warrants would be a hurdle in the Biden administration's ongoing efforts to secure a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas to allow the release of some of the more than 130 hostages still held by Hamas, according to a report by Bloomberg. The U.S. fears Israel could back out of a deal if warrants are issued, Bloomberg reported. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, at a meeting of the World Economic Forum in Saudi Arabia, urged Hamas on Monday to swiftly accept Israel's latest proposal. which he called extraordinarily generous. The only thing standing between the people of Gaza and a ceasefire is Hamas, Blinken said. Jean-Pierre did not say whether the U.S. was concerned ICC warrants could jeopardize a ceasefire pact. Irene?
Okay, next article on this page, Title IX Changes Aim to Protect Against Abuse, by Rachel Barber of USA Today. President Joe Biden has unveiled a new set of sweeping changes to Title IX rules to protect survivors of abuse, LGBTQ+ students, and student parents. The regulations announced Friday reinstitute protections for student survivors of sexual assault and harassment that were rolled back during the Trump administration. They will take effect August 1st. While Biden's updates increased protections for potentially vulnerable students, they also served as an attack in his ongoing power struggle with his Republican challenger during an election year. Republican Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton sued the Biden administration Monday over new federal non-discrimination protections for transgender students and vowed not to adhere to the new rules. I am instructing the Texas Education Agency to ignore your illegal dictate, Paxton said in a statement. Your rewrite of Title IX not only exceeds your constitutional authority, it also tramples laws that I signed to protect the integrity of women's sports by prohibiting men from competing against female athletes. What is Title IX? Title IX is the common name for a federal civil rights law that bans sex-based discrimination against students, employees, and others affiliated with schools or any other education program that receives federal funding. It was enacted as part of the Education Amendments of 1972. Over the years, several presidential administrations have interpreted and updated it differently. How did Biden update Title IX? Under Biden's new rules, there will be protections from discrimination based on gender identity for the first time and harassment protections for pregnant people and student parents. Biden's changes also include an expansion to the definition of sexual assault in K-12 schools and colleges. Despite much speculation, the Biden administration did not weigh in on whether transgender and non-binary students can participate in school-affiliated sports teams that align with their gender. Lori?
Okay, moving on to page
3 minutes.
Page 6. Gnome gets bipartisan backlash for killing her dog, by Julia Gomez, USA Today. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem has been a topic of online chatter after excerpts from her upcoming memoir were published by The Guardian on Friday. In her book, No Going Back, The Truth on What's Wrong with Politics and How We Move America Forward, Noem details how she put a dog down for being untrainable. The story caught the attention of politicians on both sides of the aisle. Dogs are a gift from God, tweeted Alyssa Farah Griffin, co-host of The View and former Donald Trump White House staffer. They are a reflection of his unconditional love. Anyone who would needlessly hurt an animal because they are inconvenient needs help. The Democratic National Committee called the excerpts from the book horrifying and disturbing. Amid the backlash, Noem responded that she understands why some people are upset about a 20-year-old story, but defended the decision to kill the dog. We love animals, but tough decisions like this happen all the time on a farm, Noem said in a post on X. Sadly, we had to put down 3 horses a few weeks ago that had been in our family for 25 years. Noem is a contender to become Trump's running mate. Here's what we know about the governor. Who is Kristi Noem? According to the governor's website, Noem is also a rancher, farmer, and small business owner. She was elected to the House of Representatives in 2010 and in 2018 was elected South Dakota's first female governor. Today, she is also a New York Times best-selling author. In January of 2022, she published her first book, Not My First Rodeo, Lessons from the Heartland. And the website said she was reelected governor with the largest vote total in the history of South Dakota. Could Noem run with Donald Trump? The governor is a contender to become Trump's running mate. But recent polling from New River Strategies, which was published by Politico, says only 14% of Americans consider her a good choice for the Republican ticket. The report also says that 86% of 2020 Trump voters report liking or loving dogs, and that 39% of them do not believe she would be a good choice for vice president. Only 22% said she would be. Why did Noem kill her dog, Cricket? According to The Guardian, Noem said she killed her dog because of its aggressive personality and called the dog untrainable. And with that, we have come to the end of the hour. This is Lori Richards.
And Irene Friedman.
And we've been bringing you world and national news from USA Today and wish you a good evening.
Good night, everyone.